Thank you all for being here tonight. It's been quite a long time since my last visit to Minnesota, several years, and I have to say I had forgotten how cold it gets here. I'm from Southern California, and if it ever got this cold, nobody would go anywhere for anything. Except maybe to Disneyland, but that's questionable too. My topic this evening is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But you need to know that I'm not a theologian. I'm not a New Testament scholar. I'm not a church historian. And I'm not even an ordained minister. So you might be wondering, what am I doing here? You're a philosopher. Why would you agree to speak on the topic, the resurrection of Jesus Christ? And before we get into the material that I have for you tonight, I wanted to answer that question for you. Why would I agree to speak on this topic? First of all, I myself believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Second, I'm convinced that belief in the resurrection of Jesus, something I'll call resurrection belief throughout the evening, I'm convinced that resurrection belief is eminently reasonable, even for us living in the 21st century, living our lives in an academic setting, and seeking to be utterly intellectually responsible. Belief in the resurrection of Jesus is credible. And finally, and most relevantly, I agree to speak on this topic as a philosopher because my work in philosophy has made a significant contribution to my conviction that Jesus Christ really did rise from the dead. And so my presentation tonight adopts a philosophical approach to the question. Did Jesus rise from the dead? And on what basis would anybody be justified in believing such a thing? But of course, if the resurrection really did happen around 30 AD as purported, then that is an event that took place in space and time. That is to say, it's an event that took place historically. It is a historical event. And so, rational belief that it happened depends upon a knowledge of certain historical facts. You can't make a case for resurrection belief simply on the basis of philosophical argument. But I will argue tonight that I don't think you can make the case only on the basis of historical evidence without a consideration of philosophical assumptions that people make as they consider the historical data. And so I'll be focusing as much on the structure of resurrection belief or the logic of resurrection belief as I will on historical evidence, which is only a part of the total case for belief in such a remarkable fact. Now, obviously, millions of people who call themselves Christians throughout the world believe that Jesus Christ did rise again from the dead within, say, 36 hours after his crucifixion in AD 30. Millions of people believe this, including millions of intelligent people. In fact, in this country, just in my field alone, in philosophy, there are hundreds of Christian philosophers who teach at universities like this one all over the country. And that's just in this part of the world. And so I think that just for sociological reasons, we shouldn't think it's especially weird to have a conversation tonight at a university about something like the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But our question is, why do all these people believe this? Or why should I believe it? And like a philosopher is inclined to do, I want to turn that question inside out and ask the following question. Well, why not believe in the resurrection of Jesus? Now, this is not intended as a rhetorical question. You know how a rhetorical question works. You ask it in such a way as to imply a kind of answer. And somebody might ask the question rhetorically. You know, why not believe some particular claim or other about anything you like? Why not believe that? And it sounds like they're saying, you're the irrational one if you think it's irrational to believe. That's not the way I'm asking the question. I want to know, what are some of the primary reasons that people might give for not believing something like this? That an event, a miraculous event, the resurrection of a man from the dead, actually happened. Why wouldn't people believe that? Now, we could summarize the skepticism there is about this kind of claim very simply, couldn't we? We could say, well, look, it's just an incredibly unlikely thing. The probability of a resurrection is extremely low. Some might even say zero. Because if you look at, well, if you go to most graveyards, right, there's no evidence at all that anybody who's been buried there ever came back to life. And so if this happened to one man, Jesus Christ, this would be a truly exceptional event in the history of human experience. So it's initially very unlikely. And then there are all the laws of nature that explain why it is that when people die, they usually stay dead, right? So that is, in a nutshell, the basic basis for skepticism. But I think that we need to be more specific than that. And I think that we can be more specific than that. There are three, I think, primary reasons why many people, not all people, today have trouble believing that this happened. And the first would be for those who are atheists. You know, if you're an atheist and you believe that God does not exist, well then, of course, it's going to be very difficult for you to believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Why? Because it is such an unnatural event, and it's so unnatural that you might think it couldn't possibly happen unless it happened by supernatural cause, such as God making it happen. And for that, you have to have a God. So you can't have divine agency and you can't have a God-like action in the world unless you have a God. And if you don't believe in such a thing or such a being, then you'll have trouble believing in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, it turns out that even at universities today, most people, most students, believe in God. And so, for them, the reasons will probably be different. But there are reasons for them to consider. That brings me to the second point, why many people have trouble believing that this happened. And I think it has to do with a lack of familiarity with a body of historical evidence. And also with the relevance of belief in God to that kind of evidence. And I'll explain that a little bit later. But again, I want to qualify. I don't want to be misunderstood. I am not saying that once you are aware of this evidence and once you know what it is, you will automatically believe in the resurrection of Jesus or you'll just be an idiot. Now, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying, though, is that if a person's not familiar with the kind of evidence that I'm talking about, then that would be a good explanation for why they wouldn't believe that it happened. It doesn't follow that if they were acquainted with the evidence, well, then they would believe. But how are they supposed to believe something that they haven't examined or that hasn't seemed evidentially plausible from a historical point of view? Now, why would there be people who don't know much about the historical evidence if there is any? And there are a couple of possibilities. There are different kinds of people here. Let's go back to the belief in God business. There are people who are not atheists, but they still don't believe in God. There are people who haven't made up their minds. They don't believe that God exists, but they don't believe that God does not exist either. They're neutral on that point. They're sometimes called agnostics, right? It's people who categorically deny the existence of God who are called atheists. But both atheists and agnostics might be skeptical about the resurrection because they lack the conviction that the kind of agent required actually exists. Now, in the same case, in the case of historical evidence, we have the same division, a similar kind of division. And that is that there might be people who are not familiar with the evidence because they didn't know there was evidence of that kind. It never occurred to them that there might be evidence for such a thing. In fact, it might seem to them that you couldn't possibly have historical evidence for an event like that. Even weak evidence wouldn't exist for that sort of thing. Or they might think, well, in principle, it's possible, I guess, that you could have historical evidence for a resurrection from the dead, but I've never heard what the evidence is. I've been a university student. You know, I've been in school for a lot of years. Maybe you're a historian. You're a major in history. Maybe you do a lot of reading and you think, I've never encountered evidence for that sort of thing. And it seems like if there was good evidence for a resurrection from the dead, you know, I would have heard about it by now. Right? On the other hand, it might be that there are people who are aware of the existence of evidence like that, but they've never investigated it. And here I want to talk about a distinction between two kinds of ignorance that we're all capable of when it comes to truth or facts. There is invincible ignorance. It's ignorance we can't do anything about. And there is what you might call vincible ignorance, or ignorance that can be overcome when we perform an appropriate investigation of the facts. So there are all sorts of truths that I don't know, and I'll probably never know, or probably never could know. I am invincibly ignorant about those things. They could have to do with physical facts about faraway galaxies. Things that are true, but that I will never be in a position to know. My ignorance about those facts is invincible. On the other hand, there are all sorts of facts that I don't know that I could know if I wanted to. Or at least there are truths about certain states of affairs that I could know if I knew how to explore them and had the inclination to do so. If I wanted to know the current population of Minneapolis, as these things are normally estimated, well, I could find out. I'm sure there's a place where I could go or a person I could ask, maybe somebody here who could answer that question for me. My ignorance of the population of this city is not invincible. Now, I don't have a powerful incentive to want to know something like that. So I might not ask. If I had a reason to ask, then I might look for the right person and then I would have knowledge. And my ignorance would be replaced with awareness. Now, when it comes to the historical facts concerning the resurrection of Jesus Christ, whatever they happen to be, our ignorance may be invincible or it may be vincible. And I think that for most of us, when we're not aware of what the facts are, it's because we haven't taken the opportunity that is there, that really does exist, for us to explore the possibility that this really did happen. So one type of reason why people don't believe is that they don't believe in the kind of agent, a god, who could pull it off. But another type of reason why people might not believe, even if they do believe in God, is that they're not familiar with the historical evidence and are not in a position to believe. Now, I think there's a third, more subtle explanation for the difficulty some people have believing in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the reason why I'm going to mention it tonight is because, first of all, it is seldom mentioned when the case is presented. And I want to be open and honest about this objection or this worry. Second, it is kind of a subliminal fear, I think, or a subliminal obstacle. It's not like everybody has this explicit thought before their mind that this is a reason why they don't believe in the resurrection of Jesus. But I think when you bring it out into the open, there's a lot of recognition, yeah, that is kind of bothering me. Would you like to know what that third reason is? It is a concern about the implications if it's true that Jesus rose from the dead. What are the implications? Now, there are lots of things that we could consider. But one primary implication is the implication it has for non-Christian religions. Right? Because if Jesus Christ really did rise from the dead, well then, that has a tendency to corroborate in a unique way the claims of Christianity, and that has implications for the authority of non-Christian religious perspectives. And of course, we live in an era where that kind of is at cross grains with our legitimate desire to be tolerant and accepting towards other people. And so this is a concern that if I believe this, then I'm going to buy into this idea that Christianity is somehow exclusively true. Now, the reason why I think this is subliminal is because our culture of tolerance and the particular form that it takes today is itself absorbed in kind of a non-reflective way many, many times for most of us. And also, I think, because when you stop to think about it, if we're talking about historical facts, if we could be really convinced that something actually did happen, then it seems rationally like we should be prepared to accept the implications, whatever they are. And so if we bring out into the open this concern about this kind of implication, if the resurrection really did happen, can cause us to wonder whether this is a legitimate concern. But I actually think it is a legitimate concern. And it ought to make us require pretty strong evidence that the resurrection really did happen, because there are so many alternatives to Christian belief in the world today. All right, so as you can see, I've already taken a kind of philosophical approach to the issues. And I've explained to you why I, as a philosopher, am here tonight to talk about this issue, and what I think are three major reasons why people sometimes have difficulty believing this sort of thing, even though there are millions of other people who do. Right? They don't believe in God or the kind of God who would do this sort of thing. They're not familiar with historical evidence that is corroborative, and they might be worried about implications if it is true. Now, my particular field in philosophy, my specialization is a branch of philosophy that deals with knowledge and with evidence and with how we come to believe the things we do and with whether we're justified in believing those things. I've had the awkward experience at times of traveling and being asked by somebody who saw a doctor in front of my name, "What kind of doctor are you?" And I used to just say, well, I have a PhD in philosophy. I teach philosophy at a university. You know, that's what I do. And before I even finish the sentence, these people have already disappeared. Right? They hear philosophy and they're not interested anymore. And I often thought, why would they ask me a question like that and then not stick around for the answer? I'm telling them what kind of doctor, right, I am. And then I realize they're disappointed in my response. And they know right away it's not a very good one. It's not interesting. Right? And why is that? Because they want to know what my medical specialization is. They're making an assumption about me, and then their assumption is shown to be a little misguided, and so they lose interest. And so I thought, well, I hate to disappoint people like that, but I've got to be honest, right? But then I realized, I do have a specialization in philosophy. It's called epistemology. And so I thought, the next time somebody asks me, "What kind of doctor are you?" I'm going to tell them. And so this is what I do now. I say, "I'm an epistemologist." And then I hand them my business card and I say, "And if you ever need an epistemologist, just give me a call." And nobody's called me yet. I wonder why. But they don't walk away. They just stand there and their eyes just get really big. And you can see the wheels turning. They're wondering, what part of the body are we talking about here? Epistemology. In epistemology, we consider not some part of the body, but the way the mind functions in dealing with evidence as a mechanism for deciding what to believe. And in this context, we have to understand the nature and the source of skepticism about miracles. And I've already sketched three reasons why people might have trouble believing in this particular miracle. But now I want to back off and speak more generally about varieties of skepticism. And the reason why I'm going to do this tonight is because if you have trouble believing that the miracle of the resurrection Jesus happened, it could be very helpful for you to know what kind of skeptic you are and what kind of evidence is relevant to that kind of skepticism. And there are all kinds of skeptics. And the way to begin to understand the different kinds of skeptics about this issue is to take two claims, put them side by side. The first is the claim that it is that miracles are possible. If you wanted to make it particular, you could say it is possible that Jesus Christ literally rose bodily from the dead as an act of God. Okay? That's possible. The other claim is that miracles are actual. Or if you want to particularize, Jesus Christ, right? A man with flesh and bones, living and breathing on this earth, died, and then, literally, bodily, rose again from the dead by divine action. So we've got the possibility of miracles and the actuality of miracles. Now, you can be a skeptic about one and not the other. For example, you could believe that miracles are possible, but be skeptical about whether a miracle has ever occurred. Right? That's one kind of skepticism. Or you could be skeptical about both claims. Skeptical about whether miracles are possible, and as a consequence of that, skeptical about whether they're actual. I mean, you're not going to be confident that miracles have actually happened if you're skeptical about whether they're possible. Right? I mean, if you had good reason to think that a miracle actually did happen, that would be a reason to think it was possible. Everything that is actual is possible. What could be more obvious than that? But see, now we've got another variety of skepticism. It's skepticism about both claims rather than just one claim. Now, that is only a very superficial taxonomy of skepticism about miracles. We can go just a little bit deeper here that will be helpful for our purposes tonight. Because in addition to being skeptical about different claims, you can be a different kind of skeptical about each claim. What kind of skeptic could you be about the possibility of miracles? I'm going to make a twofold division. First of all, you might believe that miracles are not possible. In other words, you categorically deny the possibility of miracles. Or you might simply be an agnostic about the possibility of miracles. You might say, well, I don't believe that miracles are possible, but I don't believe that they're impossible either. I'm going to say, I don't know. I guess I should say it's possible that they're possible. And that's a different kind of skepticism. It's weaker than the view that categorically denies that it's possible. Now we can make the same distinction over here on the actual side. You could say, well, I don't know. Maybe miracles have happened. Maybe they haven't. I don't know what to say. I don't believe that they have. I don't believe that they haven't. Or you could categorically deny that they actually have. So you see now, we've got a complex of varieties of skepticism. And it would be good if you were here tonight as a skeptic about this claim that Jesus rose from the dead to try to figure out, you know, where exactly within this taxonomy you might come close, you might fit most closely. All right? So you could categorically deny both the possibility and the actuality of miracles, or you could affirm the possibility of miracles, but categorically deny that they're actual. Or you could affirm that they're possible, but be skeptical in the agnostic sense about their actuality. Right? Or you could be agnostic about whether they're possible and categorically deny that they're actual. Or agnostic about whether they're possible and be agnostic about whether they're actual. That's a lot of varieties of skepticism. And the kind of evidence that is relevant to each kind of skepticism is going to be different. And so now, as I think about these three primary reasons why people who are reluctant to believe in the resurrection of Jesus are reluctant, I think it overlaps with some of these distinctions about varieties of skepticism, and that's what I think will help us here next. Let me explain. Let's go back to the first reason. A reason having to do with basic assumptions about the nature of reality and how the world works, how things work. your belief about God, whether it's the belief that there is a God, or it's the belief that there isn't a God, or it's a kind of neutrality about that proposition, is a very controlling idea in your worldview, in all probability. Right? It influences other things you believe. It probably influences things you're prepared to do, priorities you set in your life, that sort of thing. It's a very fundamental kind of question. Is there a God? And it's not just the question, is there a God, but it's the question, if there is, what sort of God is God? And then it's not just what sort of God in the abstract is God, if there is a God, but it's also, if that's what God is like, if God exists, what would God be doing? How is God related to my life or this world, this universe? Where does he fit into everything else? Now you see, you can start having all these different varieties of skepticism about the different possibilities in answer to these questions about God. Does he exist? What's he like? And what's he got to do with the rest of the world? It just gets incredibly complicated. And so we're all very unique individuals, and we're all on our own journey here. And so having just a very general kind of argument that this is true or that is true or this is false or that is false oftentimes proves not to be very personally satisfying. So I think we have to be sensitive to this diversity and this variety. But let me put it this way. If there is good reason to believe that there's a God, good reason to believe it, right? It's not just a matter of faith. I'm not just saying if there is a God, because you might think that there could be a God and not be a good reason to believe. But let's say there is a God and there's a good reason to believe it. Well then, let's suppose that it's also reasonable to believe that this God is actively interested in human affairs. This God created the universe, created human beings, made us the kinds of objects we are, with incredible complexities physically and consciously. We're very different than most physical objects in the rest of the universe, as far as we can tell. We're self-conscious and self-aware. We ask the big questions. Sometimes my dog, Casey, an Australian Shepherd, looks like he's dumbfounded by some ultimate question about the nature of the universe. But I'm not genuinely convinced that he's really pondering these things. I think he's just hungry. And my empirical evidence for that is that it goes away as soon as he eats something. It's not how it works for me. We ask deep questions about human existence. Why am I here? Why are we here? Why are we, the kinds of objects that we are, capable of consciousness and self-determination through the exercise of free choice? Why is there something like that in the universe? And what is the point of it, if there is a point? It's tempting to think that because it's a thought we can think. And if it's a thought we can think, well, then it's an interesting question. We die. And all of us expect that that's going to happen someday. Well, then what? Is that it? Is it over? Now, we might not like that prospect. Some people are perfectly content with that prospect. Some people will say, bring it on. But other people are not so sure. And maybe they don't particularly want to have a life after death, but they're not sure they can do anything about it. I mean, after all, what did you do to determine whether you would come to be at all? That really wasn't in your power, was it? I mean, I didn't make the decision to exist. Maybe it's not up to me whether I'm going to continue to exist after I die. Well, now that's a pretty spooky idea. And you'd like to know, well, what are my chances of getting that right, you know? It's a big question for the human condition. What are some other big questions? What about being a good person? I suspect that everybody in this room desires deep down to be a good person. I mean a morally virtuous person. Really desires that. But we all have problems of the same sort. There's confusion about what that means. What does it mean to be a good person? And people disagree about that. What is the good life? Not everybody has the same account. And yet if we're all alike and having a similar nature, maybe there should be more agreement than there is. But then, on what basis would we agree? That's another problem. And then, even if we could agree, or even if I could be convinced what it would mean for me to be a good person, and I do have ideas about that, I find that I'm not altogether capable of being consistent with my own principles. So as much as I want to be a good person, I oftentimes fail to be that person. Well, that's another feature of the human condition. And then there's pain and suffering. See, now this is kind of a heavy, right? Dark cloud descends over the auditorium here. I'm bringing up all the big questions that are not easy to answer. And now, like, this is the biggest and most frightening. Is there any point to human suffering? You know, when we are compelled to ask the question, why am I suffering? Or why do these people, these innocent people, say, suffer the way they do? We are attributing dignity to those people. Because otherwise, it would just be some transformation of energy and physical stuff, and it wouldn't have any special significance. You'd call it pain because of maybe the physical character of it, maybe manifesting consciousness in some way. But we think it's got meaning. There's a deeper meaning to our experiences of pain and suffering. But do we understand what it really means? Do we know why we suffer? Is there any point to it? Can it accomplish any good? What would ensure that that's the case? Now, these are all very big questions, and I'm not even going to try to answer them tonight. But here's what I want to suggest. If there is a God who created the universe, and we are also creatures in this universe caused by God so that we depend for our existence and our nature and our dispositions and our ability to ask these questions on the Creator, this God, if we depend on that Creator for all of those things, then at least we would probably like to think that this God is genuinely concerned about our welfare, really is interested, right? That's what we would like to think. I mean, how would you like to be in the vulnerable position you're in, believe that there's this powerful God, but He really doesn't care? You go through life a little differently. You feel a certain way everywhere you go. So you might think, well, God either is indifferent, or worse, He is malevolent. He's got it in for us. Or God has some purpose, and all of these questions have solutions, and that God has a way of dealing with the human condition that reflects positively on His nature, just like the fact that He created us seems to itself, because there are many good things about being alive and living in this world and having a universe that's so nicely arranged for our comfort. That was God's idea too on this hypothesis. So what we have now is a certain tension. And it's a tension between the hypothesis that God is powerful and benevolent and creative and thoughtful, and He gives us our lives, and yet, on the other hand, we've got all these questions and some deep problems that we can describe together as part of the human predicament. And that tension suggests either He is surprisingly indifferent, stunningly malevolent, or wonderfully concerned. Okay, now that's important background. What you believe about those possibilities will influence what you're prepared to believe about the possibility and the actuality of a miracle like the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Because if God is good and we're in trouble, then it's reasonable to expect God to do something that would rescue us from that peril. That would be a reasonable expectation. And then, we should like to know that whatever is God's own way of dealing with that really is God's way of dealing with it, and not some counterfeit that won't actually deal with it adequately. Now, let's suppose God then was concerned, wanted to do something, and took some action that was his way of dealing with it, and wanted us to recognize it as his own way of addressing the human condition. How would we know it? How would we recognize God's invasion into the world of human experience in a way that radically addressed the human problems? It seems to me one option at God's disposal would be to do something that only God could do. That would make it easier for us to believe that what we would naturally expect really did happen, right? So we would want, at best, to have some indication that God was acting in a way that only God could. Now, what we're really asking for is a miracle. Now, this has changed the context for weighing the possibilities of rational belief in something like the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And we haven't even looked at historical evidence yet. I have found that for me, the most compelling basis for considering the evidence is to reflect, first of all, on whether there is any likelihood at all that our Creator would just leave us to our own devices, or alternatively, do something radical, demonstratively divine, to solve the problems of the human condition. Now, we know, if we know anything about Christianity, that this is what Christians believe God has done in sending His Son, Jesus Christ, to fulfill Jewish messianic expectation, but also this longing that other people have, Jewish or not, for a solution to the problems of our human lives. And that Jesus was unlike other human beings in that He was a revealer of God's way of dealing adequately with the problem. And so, if this is true, and then we find good reason to think that He rose from the dead, that would fit a natural expectation we have of God. And so now we can function somewhat like detectives do, right? When they investigate the scene of a crime, they go to the scene of the crime and they collect evidence and they put it in bags, right? They take fingerprints, and they go to a laboratory for examination. And while they're doing that, they go around and interview people and they look for a good candidate perpetrator of that particular crime. And when they grab somebody, there are certain things they want to know about that person. They want to know, is this person capable of that crime? That's a question about their character. They also want to know, would this person have any special motive? That's going to relate to their character, but it's separate, isn't it? And then third, did this person have the opportunity? And if all the circumstantial evidence points to this person, and on top of that, you've got character, motive, and opportunity consistent with what actually happened, then you've got a good case for arresting the person, or if you've already done that, for prosecuting him in a court of law. Now, what are the parallels in our situation here? What we have here is a theistic context, a context where we take seriously the possibility of a God who has the relevant sort of character, motive, and opportunity to do something like a resurrection for an appropriate sort of figure. The question now is, what is the circumstantial evidence that is required to go with that, that would give us any conviction at all that this has actually happened? And that, finally, is what brings us to the question of historical evidence. And this is where there is a great deal of scholarship and a lot of work has been published. In fact, later this evening, you'll be invited to accept a complimentary copy, I think, of a book called... am I right about this? More Than a Carpenter, right? That book will give you, in parts of it, a sampling of some of the historical evidence. There's a book out on the table called In Defense of Miracles, where there's a chapter on part of the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and then another one on another part of the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. There's been a lot of work on this. And with all of the scholarship among historians of the New Testament and of Christianity, some of them conservative Christian people, others of them skeptical and critical, there is one thing in particular where there is amazing agreement. First, we have to know what it is they agree about, and then we have to understand why it is so amazing. It is this, that the early disciples, the first Christians, during that period that is sometimes called primitive Christianity, in the first decade of its existence, following the 30s AD, there were people who literally believed in the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. They really believed it. They didn't believe it because that's what they were taught when they were growing up. They were taught something completely different about the nature of resurrection than what they came to believe later. They were Jewish people. They had the idea that at some future time in the eschaton, at the end of the age, there would be something called a general resurrection, where all the righteous would be resurrected together. And then it's a little vague about what would happen next. But there would be that sort of thing for sure. Meanwhile, people would die and there would be a period, an interval before this general resurrection. Well, now some of these people who believe this came to believe something different than that. They didn't stop believing in a general resurrection, but they came to believe something in addition to that, and that was that one person was raised individually during their own lifetime ahead of the general resurrection. And in fact, this belief gave them more confidence than they had before that there really would be a general resurrection that would include themselves, because they knew this person, Jesus of Nazareth. Nobody really seriously disputes the thesis that they genuinely believed in the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. You can just look it up, read historians, and you find agreement. Now, why is that significant? Why is that remarkable? Because now we want to know, well, why would they believe that? Why would they come to believe something like that? They knew Jesus personally, so this wasn't based on the testimony of people living centuries before them. They are eyewitnesses to the life of this person. And they come to believe that he died, like others, a horrible death that was so painful and so excruciating and so definitive that there could be no question of his death. They believed later, though, and not very much later, that he was alive again. Why? Well, they've told us why. They've told us what their own reasons are. And they have to do with two facts, things that they would consider historical facts. First is the fact of the empty tomb where Jesus had been buried after he was crucified. And second is the fact that he appeared to them, sometimes individually, sometimes in small groups, sometimes to them and others in larger groups. He appeared to them alive again after he died. We could call those post-mortem appearances of Jesus Christ. And those two facts together implied something truly remarkable. Right? Now, look, you need both. If you have an empty tomb but no appearances, nobody ever sees this person, then there are all sorts of other possibilities. The body disappeared somehow, but it doesn't follow that he rose from the dead. I mean, graves have been robbed before. Maybe that happened in this case. But if you have appearances together with the empty tomb, well, that's a different story. Alternatively, you could have appearances that were really, really compelling. And they were especially compelling because of their quality and because they were experienced by other people, different times. So you could corroborate your testimony, talk to other people. Hey, did you see him too? But you still might think, let's go check where he was buried. Just, you know, in case there's a twin. And so you march over to the tomb. You investigate. It's empty. Now for them, it didn't really happen like that because the empty tomb was discovered before anybody saw Jesus alive. He was seen alive very soon after that by certain people, and there would have been people who saw him alive but never saw the tomb empty, I'm sure. But some who did see it empty saw it empty before they saw him. And you can just imagine how frightening it was to see the tomb empty, but then to see him afterwards, much more so. Now, I want to just submit, you might think I'm crazy here, but I'm just going to suggest, hint here, for something for you to consider, that if you were in that position where you knew Jesus, you saw him crucified, you knew where he was buried, and you visited the tomb following his death to make preparation for his body, something that needed to be done by a certain time in Jewish customary practice. If you were doing all of those things and you showed up there and he wasn't there, right, you would believe his body was gone. But you might not believe that he was alive. If you then turned around and walked out of the cemetery and on your way encountered someone who seemed to be identical with this person that you knew before he died, I want to suggest that you would be very tempted to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. In fact, I suggest it would be almost impossible not to believe it. Now, that is without the benefit of the context of understanding the life of Jesus himself and how he talked about himself and what he was going to do, and he even predicted his own resurrection, but people didn't know what to make of it. They weren't even sure what he was talking about because it wasn't part of the framework of their understanding that that could ever happen. So you start putting more and more of these details together. If you're there witnessing these things, it's going to be hard for you not to believe it. And if you believe it, you're probably not going to just sit around and ponder it by yourself and never say anything to anybody. The word's going to get out. And if you find out that other people have also seen these same things, a community will be formed naturally. All right, so you can explain early Christian belief in the resurrection of Jesus if that's true. If you don't believe that's true, then you need to explain it some other way. But it is true that they believed it. That part you can't deny. So you've got to explain that somehow. And I think the best thing to do is to begin by asking them, why exactly do you believe that? Now, it turns out that there is independent historical evidence for the empty tomb and for the appearances. And there are no very good alternative explanations for these phenomena. And all I want to say about that is this. A tomb that's empty in and of itself is not a surprising thing. Right? It was empty before he was buried. Am I right about that? So is that the sort of thing that historians could investigate? Well, they could. And if there was the right sort of testimony or if there were the right sorts of records left behind, you could know with historical probability that some tomb existed and at a certain time there was no body in the tomb. And you wouldn't have any problem with that, right? You wouldn't have any trouble believing that. Alternatively, if somebody claimed to be acquainted with some person that he met with on occasion, where they ate together and they conversed with each other and they walked along the road together, they spent time together, and this person claimed that it was the same person on all these different occasions, right? That's the sort of thing a historian could, if he had the right kind of evidence, good narrative, good testimony, good records, and where the narrative itself was consistent with other things the historian knows about the culture, about the government of the time, all of these things, a historian would say, yeah, given all of this data, we believe that this person and this person had an encounter on this occasion. No problem. Now, in a sense, that's all we're talking about. Somebody showed up, looked in a tomb, a cave, and there was no body there. That's the sort of thing a historian, could investigate. And we've got the claim that people met this person that they knew from before, recognized him, talked with him, interacted with him, and were not under the illusion at all that it could have been somebody else. That, again, is something a historian, in his capacity as a historian, could investigate and could believe is true. So where's the problem? The problem is the timing and the set of circumstances before that. Because now we've got a tomb that is missing a body that was there. And now we've got encounters with a person who is dead. That's the only problem here. And you might say, well, that's a pretty big problem. And it is a pretty big problem. But the point is to understand that the claims themselves are not beyond historical investigation. They are just the sort of things that you could, as a historian, reasonably come to believe if you had the right kind of evidence, the evidence that historians deal with. And that's the claim that people who investigate the evidence believe. Now I say, why are there skeptics who accept many of the historical facts? Some of them, I've heard that as many as 75% of New Testament historians believe that the tomb was empty after Jesus was buried there. They actually believe that. And they believe, the vast majority of New Testament scholars, critical and non-critical, believe that the earliest Christians really did have experiences of the presence of Jesus Christ, as if he were alive. They don't doubt that. But they still don't believe in the resurrection if they're skeptics. Why is that? That's the question. Why would they be willing to grant these claims about the historical facts and not make the inference that the people themselves made when they were there experiencing those things? And I think the main reason why is because they don't believe that it's possible. And that brings us back to a question. Is there a God who has the relevant sort of character, motive, and opportunity to do something like that? I want to give you a suggestion. Many of you are university students. You're here at the University of Minnesota. And maybe you have university professors here who know something about the evidence of the New Testament and the historical evidence of for early Christianity, primitive Christianity. And you might ask one of your professors whether this person, he or she, believes what the Bible says about Jesus rising from the dead. And I wouldn't be surprised, you won't be surprised, if this person says, well, no, I don't believe that. Ask this person, just out of curiosity, do you believe in God? Surely, this is relevant. In a moment, I'm going to give you a question, an opportunity to respond, and with your questions and your comments, I'm anxious to hear what they are. Let me conclude with a little quick story about my own experience. About a year ago, before the hurricane, I was in Louisiana. I was in New Orleans, and I was participating in a conference on the resurrection of Jesus. And there were critical scholars, and there were conservative scholars, and some were New Testament specialists, historians, others were theologians, a couple of philosophers there. And we were interacting with the scholarship of two prominent scholars who are historians. One, conservative, believes in the resurrection of Jesus, the other one who doesn't. N.T. Wright, British scholar, Bishop of Durham in England. And the other, John Dominic Crossan, now retired, university professor, who was a prominent member of the Jesus Seminar. Basically a skeptical group of Jesus historians. I had read many of the books by John Dominic Crossan, and I was to make a presentation on this, and he was supposed to come up and respond. Well, the day before, I thought, I'll ask him a few questions because I don't want to misrepresent his views. And he can correct me if I'm wrong, and then I'll make sure I get it right. And I said to him, you know, in your book, you use the term God repeatedly, and you show tremendous respect for the person, the historical person of Jesus. But you believe that when he died, his body was tossed aside in an empty field and maybe, you know, a thin layer of dirt was covered over it, and then some dogs came and basically chewed up everything. And that's what happened. He said, that's right. And I said, well, what about the appearances? And he said, well, those are apparitional experiences of grieving people who are in this psychological state, it's a perfectly normal state, where they're missing the person and they have a sense of his awareness simply because it's part of the grieving process. I said, okay. So I said, but now here in your books, you also talk about God and what God is doing in the world and what he's up to and that sort of thing. And I'd like to know, what do you mean by God? What sort of God is this? See, I'm a theist. I believe at least this much about God. That God is omnipotent. That God is omniscient. He knows everything that could possibly be known. That God is omnibenevolent. He is perfectly morally good. And I believe that he's the creator of the physical universe. There are other things I believe, but let's just start with that. Do you believe these things? And he said, no. Now that is a very significant fact when you think about how a person is going to make sense of the physical evidence. He has no special evidence that anything that he says about what happened to the body of Jesus really did happen to the body of Jesus. There are no records that say that's what was done. But he's pushed in that direction because it's a possibility that he can make sense of in light of the fact that other things simply aren't possible. Because there is no omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent creator of the physical universe who could possibly personally intervene on our behalf out of interest in the human predicament in demonstration of his goodness and his love through his prophet, Jesus Christ. So in summary, I simply want to say that if you're willing to examine the historical evidence, would you also consider examining your own assumptions about what that evidence can mean, given what you believe about God, his character, his motive, and his opportunity? Now it's your turn to respond.
In addition to some of the books that you've talked about, where are some other places that we can look for, you know, these, the work that people have done historically about the event of Jesus, you know, dying and, you know, the resurrection time and the experiences that other people had in seeing him?
That's a good question. There are bibliographies. There's a bibliography for each chapter in this book that's out there. So my first suggestion would be to look at things on that bibliography. And they're pro and con. You get some that are more skeptical than others. And in these materials, at least in this book, In Defense of Miracles, you have explicit interaction with critical scholars whose work is cited in footnotes and so forth. So that'll direct you to literature that comes from different points of view. Your question leads me to say something else that you didn't really ask me about. But quite often, I've had students say to me that they've heard in their classes a certain perspective on the history of early Christian belief, and it's of some skeptical sort. And it's the only sort of sophisticated university-level presentation they've ever heard. And they get the impression that that's as good as it gets. And so I've encouraged students like that to go back to those teachers and ask them for a bibliography of scholarship from a more conservative point of view, just to see what the counterbalancing position might look like. And I don't always have the opportunity to hear what happens when people do this. But I'm sure it's different things happen in different circumstances. But if a critical scholar says, well, there isn't any reputable or respectable historian, right, with appropriate credentials publishing on this topic with legitimate academic presses who take a more conservative view, then he's either not paying attention to his own discipline or he's not being honest about the nature of the scholarship. And I think that we should naturally assume that people that are in the business of helping us learn are aware of these things, and they are interested, they are willing to help us with questions like that. So I would just offer that as a piece of advice for those of you who really are interested in seeing a balanced perspective. Ask for sources on that from both, and I think you'll find that in this bibliography.
I might just say, Doug, that my experience is that I think if you do that sort of thing, I think there will be a positive response. I think most scholars in a place like this and those who teach this here at the U are willing to do that very thing you're suggesting. If asked to do so,
right,
they're going to present something different. But if you ask for it, they're going
That's the difference. And I'm a university professor myself, and I have a certain, you know, limited amount of time and objectives pedagogically, and I make a presentation in class on some point, and I can't do justice to all the different possibilities. But if somebody comes up to me and says, you know, what about this, then it's part of my responsibility, right, as a model of intellectual responsibility to tell a student, well, here's where else you can turn so you can get a broader range of perspectives on this point.
Aside from what's written in the Bible, is there any other documented historical evidence that would say this is what these people saw, this is where the tomb was, this is who found it empty and when?
There's two things to say in response to the question. One is a direct answer to the question, and then one is to address what is an assumption many people have when they ask that question. Okay, so first let me talk about whether there's other extra-biblical evidence, as it's called. Extra-biblical being up over and above whatever the Bible says that's historical. And the answer is yes, but it's not as rich as you might want it to be. Tacitus was a Roman historian who refers to Christian believers and to the man Jesus. Josephus does the same thing. And some of their comments are rather cryptic and not at all as full in their development of events as the Gospels of the New Testament. So that's just a straightforward fact of the matter. Their testimony, as limited as it is not irrelevant because, again, it's evidence of bona fide belief on the part of these people who lived at the time of Jesus in the region where Jesus lived. So that's significant. A second thing that goes with that, that really comes back to the assumption business, is that the Gospels themselves are a source of historical evidence or of historical knowledge. And we have to be careful about this because, as you know, or you probably know, Christians believe that the Bible is more than that, that the Bible is actually a revelation from God, that it isn't just that God sent His Son, but that He also produced a revelation with a lot more helpful information about these questions that we ask. And so that gives the Bible a kind of status that other books don't have from the Christian point of view. But let's suppose we set that aside and we don't assume that because we don't believe that yet. Let's just set that aside. What follows about the nature of the Gospels, which are part of the Bible? What does that imply about the nature of those books? Does it mean that they have no historical value? Well, that doesn't follow, does it? They do have historical value. And that's why you get agreement among scholars who don't, for example, believe that it's inspired by God. They get agreement about the bare facts of belief, the empty tomb, these experiences of the appearances of Jesus and all that. That you can even believe that there are contradictions in the narratives. You could even believe that there are contradictions in the different accounts of what took place and who got to the tomb first, if you want to. And some historians might think that there are some discrepancies there. But that doesn't prevent them from noting that there are elements of historicity that you can discern. And that's all we're doing, is we're using the Bible in much the same way. And so now it has an equal claim to being a reliable source for historical information as Tacitus or Josephus or any other historian of late antiquity.
Yeah, you said a couple things. I guess what I got out of it was that the if a person's assumptions don't allow for a God who acts in divine action in this world, because there may be a belief in naturalism and materialism or just in a kind of a God that is a deistic, non-acting God. You know, those assumptions, then the historical evidence may not overwhelm them with the kind of impression or powerful, overwhelming truth value that they're just going to be persuaded, you know, in that regard. So I'm wondering, are you working on an apologetic or a theology that begins to talk about, you know, the kind of a God that can work in divine action in a universe where our assumptions and our epistemology, our knowledge of how what we know is based on a scientific or naturalistic assumption that, you know, that, that evidence is important. And, you know, given the fact that, you know, we believe in a contingent and a rational universe, you know, can we present a view of God that is rational and consistent and able to do miracle that is not considered to be outside the realm of a rational universe?
Right.
And so some of the implications of that.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me get at it this way. I think that when historians do what historians do, there are certain things that are peculiar to their discipline that contribute to the conclusions that they draw. But that's not all that influences their historical reconstruction of past events. They also take what they know from other disciplines, other domains of knowledge. So, for example, they might take what they know about human psychology as relevant to making sense of somebody's action in the past, or what the chances are that a person like that would have chosen to do that or instead would have been compelled by outside forces. That's all psychology and sociology and anthropology. And then there's just knowledge of artifacts that comes from archaeology. And a historian is in a different situation than so many other scholars and other disciplines in that his work depends upon the results of scholarship in other domains like that. And that's why when John Dominic Crossan says, but I think that these experiences of the appearances of Jesus by these first Christians are just apparitions, he's saying this makes sense psychologically. See, he's relying on what he thinks is a good model of human psychology during the grieving process. Now, that's not a uniquely historical result, but he's taking what he knows besides what he knows from history and adding it so that he can make sense of the history. Now, that's important background because that means that when we do history in a responsible way, we should try to do it making use of everything we know that's relevant to understanding the facts. I mean, we can get the bare facts, but we now want to make sense of them, and that's going to depend upon exploiting everything else we know that could possibly be relevant. Okay? Now, that, I think, is just sort of manifest in historical practice. Well, now, does that mean, then, that we're only, as historians, supposed to do that with respect to things that we all agree on? I don't think so, because there might be things that one person knows that other people don't know. And there could be a good explanation for why some know it and others don't. There's a good explanation for why some believe it and others don't. Some historians are theists, they believe in God, and some aren't. Some are atheists. And they might have really good reasons for that. But there really aren't good historical arguments for being an atheist, right? And maybe not in general for being a theist either. So that's probably coming from their evaluation of other things. Now, I want to say that, yes, if a community has broad agreement about what is true, say about metaphysical issues like if there's a God and could miracles happen and are natural laws going to determine everything that happens, if they had absolute agreement on all those things, well, then that might count as something we know, such that when we do an examination of these evidences, it has a controlling effect on our results. But there isn't that kind of agreement. That's one of the most contentious things, period. And so now it becomes a matter of what does the individual historian think he knows? And there, I think, if the individual historian thinks he knows that there is a God, or he has very good reason to believe it, then it's not clear that that should not be a factor in his historical evaluation, because it now gives him a range of possible explanations that wouldn't exist otherwise. And it allows him to concede the facticity of certain things for which there's very, very good historical evidence, and he might feel pressed to wonder how he could conclude that if it wasn't even possible, you see? So the whole point is, it's always appropriate, I think, when you do history, to rely on anything else you know or believe you know, right, in making sense of what's going on. And that's what I've been saying here tonight. So really, many debates between historians about these historical facts concerning the resurrection are taking place at the wrong level sometimes. They might want to take, you might want to bring them back to presuppositions about what's possible, what kind of world we live in, and so forth. And after all, if God does exist, are we going to have a methodology in scholarship where we want to know truth, we want to understand facts? Are we going to require a method of scholarship that absolutely precludes our ever knowing what's true if what's true is that God did it? Let me add something to that. Don't misunderstand me here. I'm not saying that Christian scholars agree on how to combine the case, make the case complete. I'm talking about the structure of evidence here tonight, and that's my take on how to do that. But I've got colleagues who are also Christian scholars who don't go this way on these things. So I can describe at least three possibilities, only one of which is what I've been talking about. N.T. Wright, right? A British scholar, New Testament historian, he thinks that there is absolutely almost unequivocal evidence that the resurrection occurred. But he's not sure that you can then say that implies that it's a miracle and that God exists. On the other end of the spectrum, two other friends of mine, William Craig, Bill Craig, and Gary Habermas, they think that there are other reasons to believe in God, but quite apart from those reasons, this historical evidence for the resurrection gives us its own reasons because it implies a miracle. I stand between. I say if you're going to be fully convinced that that Jesus really did rise, then you probably should then infer the existence of God as the best explanation. But if you don't have independent reason to do that, then you're in a bit of a bind to rely so heavily on just historical evidence of this kind. In other words, if all you've got is historical evidence that a miracle happened and therefore God exists, then your evidence has to be incredibly strong. And maybe it is. On the other hand, if it's just some of the evidence for something like that, and behind that is a background of other evidence, very strong evidence from cosmology and design and metaphysics and so forth, then your evidence from history for a resurrection doesn't need to be nearly as strong. And that's my point.
I have a question, actually. Let's grant, for purposes of the question, the sort of God that we've stipulated, who would, I'm trying to remember your list of adjectives, but we had omniscient, omnipotent, omnibenevolent, creator of the universe. So therefore miracles are possible. How then do we adjudicate miracle claims? Because, I mean, there are lots of alleged miracles that have taken place in, you know, lots of religions, and I am assuming that you don't believe in sort of every sort of benevolent supernatural thing that's been claimed to have happened. So what is our methodology? How do we distinguish between, you know, those claimed miracles that you would say happened and didn't?
That's a great question. First of all, we're not motivated in the same way to investigate every miracle claim. All right? There might be a miracle claim that isn't even grounded in evidence. A person simply makes the claim and that's it. You ask them, why do you think it? And it's just a gut feeling, or they're the only person who witnessed it and that's it. Now, it's a lot harder to get motivated to believe that, much to investigate it any further. You wouldn't even know how to proceed, much less believe it just because of that. Also, another thing that's relevant is the nature of the miracle itself. I mean, what difference does it make? I mean, maybe it's a miracle that a parking place opened up at the mall just when I needed one. And, you know, the mall's going to close and Christmas is going to go by and my kids aren't going to have their presents. Wow, this never happens, but look, it did. Well, if I really thought it never happened, I might not even bother, right? But I'm tooling around in the parking lot and maybe I'm praying and then I see a space and I pull in. Is that a miracle? Well, I might say so. I wouldn't generally say that myself. But what What hangs on the claim that it's miraculous? Not much. It's not really significant for the lives of other people. It doesn't have broad application, and it doesn't have deep metaphysical or existential significance, even for me. If it didn't happen, it didn't happen. That's not the end of the world. My worldview is not affected. The way I organize my life, what I might start trying to get there a little earlier. I might come an hour earlier when I should come maybe 2 weeks before. All right? But I don't make a big radical change in my lifestyle or in my worldview. But when it comes to something like the resurrection of Jesus, I realize there's more at stake than that. And so that in itself is a reason to pay attention. So now if you've got interesting evidence, evidence that's provocative, and it's evidence for something that is itself much more existentially significant, not just for me, but for all of humanity, then I think it makes more sense to investigate it than other types of miracle claims. And I want to be, this is the third thing, I want to be a little bit more convinced one way or the other about this one than I am about others. So I hear all kinds of miracle claims, and I remain fairly agnostic about many of them. And I don't feel like it matters that much whether I actually believe them. But it seems to me, and that's because even if they're true, it doesn't matter whether I believe them. You see that? But in this case, if it's true and I don't believe it, I'm going to kick myself if I ever find out later that I was wrong. That's something I want to know if it's true. I want to believe in God if it's true that God exists. I'd like to believe that God does not exist if it's true that God does not exist. Honestly, I want to believe the truth. But now think about it. Which direction would I rather go wrong? If I want to believe the truth, would I rather believe that God does not exist when he does, or believe that God does exist when he doesn't? See, we're fallible. It's the same thing that operates in the court of law. We have, in jurisprudence, we have this whole, we're in a building, right? Isn't this part of the, it's not, okay. It's right over there, right? The Walter Mondale School of Law is really close by here, and they teach, right, jurisprudence and how law works and the rule of law and so on, right in that building. And one of the important principles of the rule of law is a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. A person can be guilty as the day is long and not be found guilty because of a presumption of innocence and the inability of the prosecutor to present evidence that overturns the presumption. Now, why do we presume innocence in a court of law? Because we're fallible. That's why. We would ideally like, in every case, to convict the guilty and exonerate the innocent, right? That's what we want to do. But we can't be sure of doing that all the time. So we say we could easily make the mistake of convicting the innocent and exonerating the guilty. So what do we do in that kind of situation? Well, we ask, what would we rather do among those two less than ideal alternatives? Would we rather exonerate the guilty or convict the innocent? And most people agree, without knowing any jurisprudence, that would be much better to exonerate a guilty person, than to convict an innocent person. And so we have this presumption. Now, there's a parallel in this context that we've been talking about tonight. There are certain things that, if true, you'd most like to know that they're true, and other things that, if they're true, it's almost neither here nor there whether you believe them. And I think that's a way to cut and divide different kinds of miracle claims.
Okay, this is kind of a side question. Stepping back, actually, let's say I get past the point that I believe that there's a God, but why would God be concerned about me personally? What would you say to that question?
Well, we could speculate about why God might be concerned about you personally or anyone here personally. But we might want to start at a more general level and think in terms of his concern about humanity and the course of human history and destinies and outcomes and what's going on and why there are human beings, not just why I myself exist, right? And when we get good ideas about that, then we might be able to particularize and focus locally on myself and people I know. And it might be that before we have any clear indication that God has done something demonstrating his concern, we've got some good reason to expect him to do something. Now that we have this expectation, we're alert. The antenna is up, right? The receiver is turned on. And we're looking in all the right places if we're going to find something like that. We're trying to eliminate whatever vincible ignorance we have about God's interest. Now that we've got some reason to expect it, we turn to certain places to look for it. And then if we find things that answer to that expectation in a plausible way, given their specific context, the specific evidence, then we start to have better reason for attributing to God more precise concerns, not only about humanity, but about our individual selves. Do you mind if I make one closing comment? Just in conclusion, I have said a lot of things about the nature of skepticism about the resurrection and about the kind of evidence that might be needed to deal with different versions of skepticism about this. It's pretty complex. So the structure of resurrection belief is something that you know requires quite a bit of attention, quite a bit of care. But there are three things about the resurrection of Jesus I want to say are very clear from the Christian point of view. One is that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is not a trivial feature of the Christian worldview. Christianity stands or falls for faithful Christians with the truth or falsity of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now this is fascinating because it means that it is somewhat unusual compared with other religions in being subject to this kind of historical analysis. And in a way, it says, we put the goods out there and you make the decision. And it's vulnerable, right? I mean, it's really vulnerable to that kind of historical investigation. I think that one reason why Christianity persists up into the 21st century as robustly as it does, even among very intelligent people, is because there really is compelling historical evidence. A non-Christian religion that doesn't rest its case so heavily on historical evidence might well persist just as long, but the reasons might be very different because that is not one of the vulnerabilities of that perspective. Second, the resurrection of Jesus is really unlike any other miracle, and I think it's the reason why David Hume, for example, in the 18th century, picked resurrection without referring to Jesus specifically as a peculiar anomaly that it would be very hard to believe because of its character. Dead men don't rise. I mean, that is probably the most secure generalization about the natural world that you can imagine. So if it happened, that is really a remarkable event, and it would outstrip most miracle claims of any era in terms of its miraculous character, its miraculous quality. Third, as I've argued, despite that, it's such an incredible anomaly, it is still remarkably well attested by historical evidence. That's an interesting convergence. And then finally, what we make of this claim is not just a matter of assessing historical evidence. I really think that most skepticism about the resurrection boils down to what people believe about what kind of world we live in and what kind of God, if there is a God, actually exists. If you're sufficiently impressed tonight by this evidence, then you too, if you haven't already, may come to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. If not, then you may still be haunted by the following question. What if it's true? What if it really did happen? What if the dead body of Jesus was raised from its grave to newness of life? Thank you.